You're going to love this. Just love it.
Yeah, you will. I am stuck in the middle with you on a Monday on the Bradcast. Yes, you heard me right. This is your Bradcast from Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles. 91.7 FM along the Oregon Central Coast on KYAQ. Coast to coast and around the globe on KPFK.org, on the Stitcher app, on the TuneIn app. On iTunes, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation Network, and now Radio or Not, and Radio Sputnik. Welcome to what is now your daily Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly citizen investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com. And yep, it's our first daily Bradcast. We are now going 5 days a week. It's just like the regular weekly Bradcast, except more of it. So welcome to it. Glad you could join us here this afternoon. And thanks to all of our affiliates who have jumped in to pick up the daily show from day one. And of course, they, like you, will all be happy to hear that today it's nothing but 60 minutes of nothing but Bruce Jenner. That's it. We're talking. Don't laugh. That's what we're... No, not really. We've got a big show for you, and I'll get to some of those details in a minute. But for those of you who are just listening to the Bradcast for the first time, a quick introduction of me. I am the proprietor and the creator of bradblog.com. We are well known. We have been well known for about a decade or so in covering things like voting machine concerns, election fraud, voter suppression, environmental issues, corruption, whistleblowers. Enough so that we were, in fact, the target. Desi Doyen, you'll remember, as Desi Doyen, my producer and co-host of the Green News Report, which we will be playing on this broadcast, not today, but a couple of times a week. That's a nationally syndicated report you may have heard. In any case, Des, you will remember that we have caused enough trouble that we were the target of a $12 million plot by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce some years ago to hack into our systems, to undermine our work. So we must be doing something right.
Yeah, if the Chamber of Commerce doesn't
those
like
guys,
you.
Yeah, yeah. So we must be doing something. I suspect we'll talk about that incident at some point. And I can't remember actually if that was before or after we were the first to publish over at bradblog.com insider audio from the Koch brothers' secret meeting a couple of years ago. Now they do it all the time. Now yeah, everybody's sneaking in. And,
it's true. Yeah. They were not very happy with you about
no,
that.
No, they weren't. I don't know why. In any case, we are wickedly independent. We are both loved and hated by just about everyone, which is no easy feat.
Well, mostly you hated me loved.
Yeah. Oh, they love you. Okay. All right. Well, that's a good point. You're right. In any case, glad you could join us here. That gives you some background. You'll learn more about us if you don't know who we are in the near future, no doubt. We're going to speak with legendary 1970s era Pentagon Papers whistleblower. Speaking of whistleblowers, Dan Ellsberg. In just a bit, he will be joining us to discuss the slap on the wrist penalty that disgraced general and former CIA director David Petraeus received after leaking tons of highly classified information to his lover slash biographer, and how that contrasts from punishment given out to so many other actual whistleblowers who leaked information to the media for the public good, as opposed to, you know, self-grandizement, as the Obama administration's unprecedented war on whistleblowers continues unabated in his seventh year as commander-in-chief. We'll also have a report on the ground from the ground shortly in Baltimore, where protests continued over the weekend and today over the death in police custody of 25-year-old African-American Freddie Gray, who is his funeral is actually happening as we go to air here. We'll talk to a reporter on the ground. And let's see what else we got. Oh, Desi will be joining us some more. But first, we got to get to this unspeakable tragedy over the weekend in Nepal and surrounding areas when a 7.8 earthquake struck near the capital city of Kathmandu. Search and rescue operations continue at this hour. For the latest, I want to get an update from our own Desi Doyen. Where are we now? Where are things reportedly at this moment, Desi?
Well, at this moment, officials are saying that the death toll has surpassed 4,000 people, 6,000 to 7,000 injured. They're still digging people out of the rubble. And, of course, there are still aftershocks that are going on, multiple aftershocks in the last 48 hours, one as big as 6.7 magnitude. That's a huge earthquake in and of itself. And that's knocking down buildings, and that's hampering rescue efforts as they're trying to dig people out. The aftershocks also triggered landslides on Mount Everest. Those landslides killed a confirmed 18 people so far, 41 injured on Everest, 25 still missing after the avalanches buried parts of the access routes and the base camp and a couple of other,
camps. You say 45
well.
Still missing?
41 are injured, 25 are still missing. They were traveling between base camps. International rescue teams and aid teams are beginning to arrive in the region. The United Nations says there are 14 international medical teams on the way and up to 15 international search and rescue teams that are on the way, including a search and rescue team from the United States. So far, three Americans are known to be among those killed, at least on Mount Everest. They don't have any word yet of folks in Kathmandu, the capital city. They say that Americans, about 200 Americans, are sheltering with the State Department, with the embassy in Nepal. The serious issue is now the rural areas and the mountain areas outside of Kathmandu. The epicenter of the quake was 60 miles west of Kathmandu, and it hit in the mountain areas, and no one can get to them. They're having trouble getting to them. Rescuers and communication lines have been cut off. So right now, that is one of the areas where they expect the death toll to be really high. And folks are being forced right now in Kathmandu to shelter outside. There are tent cities going up all over town because, of course, people can't be inside with all of these aftershocks. But it's also in driving rain because this is the beginning of the monsoon season. Mm. So right now, and it's just even worse because so many World Heritage sites, 4 out of 7 UNESCO World Heritage sites that are in Kathmandu Valley are said to have been either severely damaged or destroyed.
These are like these ancient hundreds villages. Years old towers and monuments and so forth that have just fallen, crumbled.
Things that were.
And there were actually, were there not workers in, I don't know if they were from the UN, but scientists who were in Nepal last week who were predicting that the signs were showing we're getting close to an earthquake, and these are concerns.
Yes, this is a recent earthquake hazards conference that actually did take place in Kathmandu last week, and the experts that were there, they said, you know, they had new data that showed that Kathmandu was due for a huge earthquake, and the geological history of Kathmandu showed that it was capable of a massive earthquake. Mm-hmm. And so they looked around, they said, we need to do something, and they had begun the process of trying to repair buildings, retrofit buildings, and get it ready. But of course, the scale of what is needed to be done was so huge that it just couldn't be done in time. And of course, no one expected it to happen this quickly.
Thank you.
So international aid organizations are accepting donations. You can check with the UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, the UN World Food Program, International Red Cross, Oxfam, Doctors Without Borders. They all say they need mostly money to help speed the aid to these areas.
Thanks for that report. We'll be keeping our eye on that, obviously, throughout the week, because that's just a unspeakable disaster out there. Thank you, Desi Doyen. Speaking of unspeakable here, not to start out the show this way with nothing but bad news, but also over the weekend, days of protests over the death of Freddie Gray in police custody turned violent. Questions remain how Gray, who was arrested on weapons charges on April 12, ended up dying in police custody with a severe spinal cord injury that resulted in his death 7 days later. Gray's funeral is being held today after, according to AP, thousands of protesters took to the streets Saturday in the largest Freddie Gray rally yet. And after hours of peaceful demonstrations, pockets of protesters smashed out police car windows and storefronts. Two people were hurt in the mayhem, and at least a dozen were arrested. Authorities have not explained how or when Gray's spine was injured. Police have said Gray should have received medical attention at the spot where he was arrested before he was put inside a police transport van, handcuffed and without a seatbelt, a violation of the department's policy. In her first public comments since Gray's death, his twin sister, Frederica Gray, appealed for calm on Saturday as she appeared with the mayor at a news conference. She said, "My family wants to say, can you all please, please stop the violence?" She said, "Freddie Gray would not want this. Violence does not get justice." There have been near daily protests since Gray's death. And as I said, today there was a service and his funeral is ongoing even as we speak. For a report on what's going on the ground in Baltimore, we go to Cassandra Fairbanks of Sputnik News, who was there during the funeral today and during the protests over the weekend. Cassandra, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, thank you.
So what's the mood like? Are things calmed back down again now with the funeral ongoing today, or are we still seeing protests out there in Baltimore?
Well, at the moment, I'm at the cemetery. The funeral procession just got here, so people are pretty somber and calm. But as the hearse left the church, people were definitely, angry. And there's a lot of tension here, a lot of anger, a lot of frustration, and it's palpable. You can tell.
Now, I believe the family is asking for a day of calm today while he's laid to rest. Is that correct? Can you confirm that on the ground, Cassandra?
Yes, they have.
And you now, as I understand, were in Ferguson when the worst of those protests happened. And as I recall, in the death of Michael Brown, his family also asked for a day of calm on the day that he was buried. But things changed. You told me earlier today things changed, right at midnight of that night?
Yeah, on that evening, everything was calm and quiet and somber, and people gathered at the memorial. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as it was midnight, people took the streets again.
And is there some concern that may happen out in Baltimore tonight?
I definitely wouldn't be surprised if that happened. There's a lot of people here and a lot of anger and frustration.
You were there over the weekend when these protests, according to AP, turned violent. Can you confirm that? Because we've seen a lot of reports over the years out here. I recall on the West Coast during the Occupy protest in Los Angeles and up in the Bay Area, where there were a lot of reports of violence, protesters turned violent, and when you looked at it, it actually was either A, not quite as violent as it was painted, or it was the police in some fashion starting the protests. What were the protests like over the weekend? And is AP accurate when they say that violence broke out in those Freddie Gray protests in Baltimore?
There was definitely some property damage, but I wouldn't necessarily say that the protest was violent. Of course, everybody reacts to things like this differently. So there were a few people who were, breaking windows and stuff like that. But the more aggressive people who were there were the police. And the police are always the ones who are escalating the situation, at least at any protests that I've personally been to, here and Ferguson included. Mm. So while there was like anger and rage, I wouldn't necessarily say that the protest itself was violent other than incidents.
Isolated incidents. Did you see in Baltimore, have we seen what we saw in Ferguson, the sort of over-militarization of the police? Are they turning out in those big armored vehicles and everything else?
I didn't see any armored vehicles, mm-hmm. but there was a lot of riot police surrounding mm-hmm. various buildings. The cops were on horses, mm-hmm. a lot of them. So they were making, they were forming lines of riot police. I think that they had called in the state troopers who were policing the protests, but they were all in riot gear. None of them had badges. Like, nobody had identification on, no badges, no name tags.
They weren't wearing their badges. They were putting tape on them, or because we've seen that out here in LA. So you're during the Occupy protest.
Yeah, we saw that during Ferguson too.
Wow.
That was definitely one of the first things I noticed.
Wow. All right. Well, I'm glad that for the moment, in any event, that things are calm out there in Baltimore. Cassandra, please stay in touch throughout the week as events move forward. And as things change, hopefully they continue to stay calm but loud and clear out there as we try to figure out what the hell went on in Baltimore with Freddie Gray. Cassandra Fairbanks from SputnikNews.com. Greatly appreciate your report, Cassandra. Stay in touch.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and come back with legendary 1970s whistleblower Dan Ellsberg. A lot going on today. Stay tuned. And Desi's going to, and we're going to try to lighten it up a little bit later with these crazy people from the Heartland Institute who are heading to Rome to advise the Pope that there is no global warming. All of that. And, oh, Loretta Lynch finally sworn in as U.S. Attorney General today. A big day. Stay with us. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast.
Talk about the weather.
Shh. It's a military secret.
Just keep your wits together.
Shh. That's the safest way to keep it.
These are critical times. Be careful of espionage.
In such critical times, you've got to watch out for sabotage.
Oh, yeah.
You gotta
watch out for it. Hey, welcome back.
Don't give any information.
This is the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. It is the daily Bradcast at this point, so welcome back to it. At an unprecedented news conference earlier today at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., U.S. government whistleblowers spanning a range of eras in national security agencies, including 7 former officials with the NSA, CIA, FBI, State Department, and Pentagon, spoke out against the Obama administration's war on whistleblowers. Among them was my next guest, the legendary Daniel Ellsberg. He's a former military analyst who risked decades in prison and brought the nation to a virtual standstill in 1971, when he released thousands of pages of top-secret documents to the New York Times and others concerning the U.S. government's decisions leading up to the Vietnam War, showing essentially that the Johnson administration lied us into that war. Sound familiar? Those documents became known as the Pentagon Papers, and their publication by the New York Times was challenged by the Nixon administration all the way up to the Supreme Court. Ellsberg was personally targeted by the Nixon administration, who, as part of the Watergate scandal, attempted to break in and steal medical and psychiatric documents on Ellsberg. They wouldn't have to break in today. They'd just get him off his cell phone. Ellsberg has been a strong supporter of modern-day NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden and convicted Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning, among others. He's also the subject of 2009's Emmy-nominated documentary, The Most Dangerous Man in America. In 2012, he became a co-founder of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He tweets at Daniel Ellsberg, and his website is ellsberg.net. Dan Ellsberg, sir, welcome back to the Bradcast, my friend.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Brad. Thank you.
Dan, I specifically wanted to talk with you about what happened last week when U.S. Army General turned disgraced CIA Director David Petraeus was given largely a slap on the wrist, comparatively, at least to others who have been found guilty of leaking classified information recently. I want to talk to you about that. But first, what was today's news conference about that you took part in at the National Press Club today?
We wanted to focus journalists on the fact that they have an interest as journalists in upholding the First Amendment, and that really requires them to be more knowledgeable and more active than they really have been in opposing the use by the Obama administration of the Espionage Act against sources to investigative journalists. whistleblowers, people who reveal wrongdoing or deceptions, crime, or reckless policies of various kinds, people who embarrass their agencies and their administration by revealing such things that have been wrongfully kept secret. And those are the very people now that President Obama has been assiduously prosecuting in a way that no other president has. As a matter of fact, for the reasons you mentioned, I was the first American ever prosecuted for giving unauthorized information, classified information, to Americans in 1971. And after me, there were two other cases brought before Obama. President Obama's administration has brought 10 such cases under the Espionage Act, three times as many as all previous presidents. It's a little hard to know. There's no easy answer as to why he set that record, but the worst of it is he's almost certainly set a precedent for his successors, whether Republican or Democrat, and that means we'll have less whistleblowing, less truth-telling from officials than before, and we weren't getting as much as we needed before by any means.
Mm-hmm.
So we need more Edward Snowdens and Chelsea Mannings, I would say, and other whistleblowers, not fewer. And that means that journalists have to wake up and realize that they're under attack from this administration.
Dan, I want to play a comment, actually, from President Obama a couple of days ago when he was speaking at the Director of National Intelligence Office in a second. But before I play this, I just want to get some idea. How do you explain Obama's increased war on whistleblowing and the fact that he's prosecuted so many more people than previous presidents?
I think I just said, I don't know an easy explanation for it. I ask it all the time, and people ask me, and I simply don't have a good answer. It is true that with the mass surveillance and the targeted surveillance of journalists that they do now, as in the case of James Risen, they do have more data on metadata on who they call, how long they call, when they call, and when they get together from their cell phones data and so forth. So they can present circumstantial evidence as to who is the source of a leak, which may even or may not be true, and yet is that is valid, and yet is the basis for a prosecution. We just saw that in the case of former CIA analyst Jeffrey Sterling, who was convicted recently of leaking to James Risen, something he says, by the way, that he did not do, but which there was circumstantial evidence in the form of the fact that he had been in communication with James Risen. Now, he was in communication because he was the first, he's an Afro-American, and the first CIA analyst to sue the agency for discrimination, and that's made them very angry at him, needless to say. But that gave him a reason for talking to Risen, and it may have had nothing to do with Risen's actual stories on the CIA bungle that Jeffrey Sterling had, in fact, informed the Senate about. So you have all this data now on metadata and actual, no doubt, contents in many cases. But the mystery is that George W. Bush had pretty much all that data, too. As a matter of fact, the offenses they charged Jeffrey Sterling with were under Bush. But Bush didn't indict him. It was Obama who indicted him.
Whatever
the reasons for this are, which are somewhat mysterious, it sets a precedent that I'm afraid he's not going to be the last president to abuse his powers in this way.
No, but you do raise an interesting point that perhaps some of this has to do with the fact that they have more information with which to prosecute people now because they get so much more of it. They collect so much more of it. Let me play a clip here from this is the president speaking over the weekend at the Director of National Intelligence Office, I think celebrating the 10th anniversary of this office. Here's what he had to say about secrets that must remain classified. Let me get a thought from you on this clip.
Yeah, part of what makes our job even more challenging is that despite the extraordinary work that's done here and the lives that are saved on an ongoing basis, a lot of our work still requires that we maintain some things as classified.
So you chuckle, Dan Ellsberg.
I would one would think he was talking about General Petraeus, who of course put out to his mistress and biographer Paula Broadwell some of the very most protected and sensitive information in the entire intelligence community, namely the identities of covert agents. I have a suspicion, though, he wasn't talking about Petraeus. Am I wrong?
I think he was talking in general just about some information needs to remain classified, that the government needs to keep secrets.
Yeah.
And
well,
isn't there something
very,
true
that's
about
very
that?
Plausible. Well, I don't argue with that. I would say that there's a lot of information that deserves to be secret. The identities of our covert agents, for example, which Petraeus put out. Mm-hmm. No, he shouldn't have done that. Should he go to prison for it? Well, given how much they do leak and how common that actually is for self-serving purposes, as in Petraeus's case, he was trying to get a more favorable biography from his mistress, although one suspects he didn't have to go that far exactly. He just didn't like to say no to her. In fact, when she asked for his notebooks, which had this kind of material, his first reaction, it's come out, is, no, that's code word, meaning higher than top secret. I can't give you those. But she asked again, and he found he couldn't say no. It's a question of relationship, I guess. So he shouldn't have done that. No. Should he go to prison for it? I don't think so. On the other hand, he did lie to the FBI about it, which is a felony, especially for a government official. He did say no, he hadn't kept any such data. That was untrue. No, he hadn't given it to her. That was untrue. And when they found it on him by searching his house, they found he had these notebooks in an unlocked drawer, which is not a really, you know, a good precedent for a CIA director. Although, by the way, not unprecedented. That's pretty much what they found of John Deutsch when he was CIA director, that he had on his home computer tied into the Internet the identities of covert agents.
Oh,
now, given
man.
That it's done this much and shouldn't be done, should they go to prison? I would say not. They shouldn't be charged under the Espionage Act because no one but spies should be charged under the Espionage Act, which doesn't allow you to argue in court that you did this for a good reason, that you had reason to do it, that it benefited the country, didn't harm, and so forth. You aren't able to say any of those things, and that's unconstitutional and unfair. But in the end, of course, in his case, they took away the Espionage Act charges, which, as I say, I don't complain about because nobody other than spies should be tried under that, and he's not a spy. On the other hand, I wouldn't be unhappy to see him go to jail for lying to the FBI, not because he's the first or only person to do that, quite on the contrary, because I would like to see one government official spend one day in jail, finally, for the first time, for lying to Congress or a court or the FBI under oath. It's never happened, and at least not for someone who is doing basically the government's bidding and who is in the favor of the government. So that would be a good precedent, but don't hold your breath.
No, I'm not. And I mean, ironically, they were speaking at the when the president was speaking. You know, James Clapper, I believe, is still over there at the Department of Homeland Security. He blatantly lied to Congress about, you know, what information is tracked and what isn't of from Americans.
Yeah, and, you remember that yeah. Clapper was asked by Senator Wyden, are you collecting, as head of Director of National Intelligence, are you collecting any kind of information at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? And Clapper said, no. Now, later, when Edward Snowden revealed to us, thank goodness, that in fact they were collecting information on hundreds of millions of Americans, in short, that Clapper had lied, Clapper to Congress, mm-hmm. Clapper said, well, that was the least untruthful statement I could make.
Yes.
Now, nobody challenged that. Some people laughed a little, but they didn't sort of say, Mr. Clapper, General Clapper, what would have been a more untruthful statement? It couldn't be more untruthful. That was the most untruthful statement he could make.
Yeah.
Yes would have been the least untruthful. That would have been the truthful answer. Or, I can't discuss this in open session. He could have said that.
Right.
But that would have suggested the truth. So the least communicative answer he could give was the one he did give. Was there any chance that he would be held accountable in the slightest way for lying to Congress and Senator Feinstein and the Intelligence Committee, no chance. It has never happened. And I'm saying it's time that it does happen, actually.
There is an additional, I'm speaking with Dan Ellsberg, legendary whistleblower. There's an additional sort of, I don't know if we should call it irony here or not, but in the case of General David Petraeus, the leaks, as I understand it, that he gave to his mistress slash biographer were far more sensitive than a lot of the information that, you know, whistleblowers have now been sent to jail for. The fact that he seems to get off with a slap on the wrist for something that's far more sensitive and was meant seemingly, you know, for self-aggrandizement, to show his mistress or his biography
how great he was.
That's
the reason for most leaks. One out of 100 leaks is really a whistleblower, somebody who's really trying to expose wrongdoing at their own risk, really, of administrative punishment, of losing their clearance and their career, possibly their marriage. That's a very rare thing. And on a really large scale, I was the first, in a way, to do that with 7,000 pages of top secret. Chelsea Manning, 40 years later, put out a great deal of material. So did Ed Snowden. That's pretty rare. But leaks occur every hour of the day with someone supporting their agency's budget or their poll or their policy or serving themselves. Now, I will say this. The prosecutors made a point, and the judge accepted, in accepting this plea bargain with just 2 years of probation and no jail time, that he hadn't, after all, intended to inform the public or a journalist. He hadn't given to a journalist, just to his biographer, just to his lover, who actually, by the way, did have a clearance. She didn't, it so happened, because she's in the reserves. She wasn't cleared for the code word, highly sensitive material that he was giving her, which means it was as if she didn't have a clearance. But people say, well, okay, she didn't publish that. But we actually don't know with it. I don't think she sold it to the Chinese or ISIL or anything like that. But who, did she copy it? Where did she keep the copies? Did she share it with anyone? Petraeus doesn't know the answer to that, and I'm not even sure the FBI has investigated it at all.
Well, that's so when you say
it is definitely a breach of the regulation.
Well, yeah, and when you say he wasn't sharing it with a journalist, he was sharing it with his biographer, who was going to write a book about him. So that information certainly could have gone out that way. But the fact that these folks, these whistleblowers, who are actually trying to do something good, that they seem to get punished more than those people like Petraeus and the other government officials, leakers.
Especially the ones who are threatened and now under Obama actually prosecuted. And that's not just that's not a coincidence, or it isn't even what you could call malice. Mm-hmm. The point is, what the whistleblower does is to give an investigative journalist or Congress information that the public needs to know because to hold their government officials accountable. Now, no government official in any country in the world, and really no official in any private organization, corporation, or school board, or whatever, wants to be held accountable. Accountability is not for their interest, it's for the public interest, or in the long-term interest of the institution. But no one really wants to have their deceptions, their lies, their mistakes, their wrong predictions, their possible crimes. They don't have any interest in having that disclosed. And if you're the president with the Justice Department under you and you have the chance to prosecute somebody who puts out something embarrassing like that, those are the people you prosecute, not the ones who have put out information to make you look good.
So the argument you seem to be making here is that these punishments are meted out based not so much on the damage that is done by the leaks, but just to send a message to other potential whistleblowers, don't do it. So if a guy like Petraeus, we think, oh, he's a good guy, he didn't mean to hurt anybody. These other people, though, we don't know what they might do. We don't know what other whistleblowers might expose. Therefore, we have to prosecute those who expose information as whistleblowers to send a message to others to not do it. Dan, isn't there a point to that? Let me just ask this point. Doesn't the Department of Justice, to some extent, have a point in that, okay, guys like Edward Snowden, they seem to have been very careful about what they released and who they released it to Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, et cetera. They've so far been very responsible with that information. But what about the next person who thinks they're exposing something that needs to be exposed? How do we know they will be as careful and judicious as Ed Snowden?
The Espionage Act that they've been using to prosecute these people does not allow the person charged to argue in front of a jury or to present testimony or evidence that they had a good motive or that they believed that this would benefit the public, and that's why they were taking the risks, which you can't avoid in putting out information that your boss doesn't want, that there was a reason for doing it and that the public needed to know this. That's not something a person accused under the Espionage Act can argue in front of the jury. I couldn't, and none of the people indicted were able to make that argument in front of a jury. Mm. Now, the jury doesn't have to believe that. They don't have to agree with you, even if they think you're telling the truth and that you had a good motive. They don't have to decide that it was a good enough motive in order to break your promise not to give secrets, which is what involved here, not to give away secrets. They can still convict, but they'll do it on the basis of having heard your argument. That is not available under the Espionage Act, and that means that a person who's giving information for patriotic motives to benefit the country, as, let me say, I did, and I'm convinced that Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden did, but also several of the people who were indicted here, not all of them, not Petraeus particularly. He couldn't really argue that he was doing this for the good of the country. But the others, some of the others could, and some could not. A jury would not have to agree with any of them, including me. But when I was asked by my lawyer, why did you copy the Pentagon Papers, which for your hearers was 7,000 pages of top secret documents, why did you do that? I wasn't allowed to tell the jury. Mm. That means I didn't have a fair trial, and none of these other people have either. And moreover, it means the purpose of all this is to discourage anyone from giving embarrassing information to a journalist, just the information the public may need in order, as I say, to hold them accountable. Now, people give unembarrassing information that makes the officials look good, like Petraeus to his mistress, or various presidents who put out classified information that makes their administration look good. That will not be prosecuted. And so the administration doesn't want to discourage people from talking to journalists so long as what you tell is in line and supports government administration policy. Mm. They don't want to break off those contacts. But what they do want to do is to break off all unauthorized contacts that might involve giving information that does not put the government in a good light. Now, if you can cut that all off, then you succeeded in the ambitions of virtually all officials of all kinds, with the unfortunate effect that you have lost democracy. You have lost accountability. You have lost an informed public that can influence policy or make informed choices of who to vote for. And that's, to a large degree, where we are, and I hate to say that. Our democracy has eroded very, very heavily since 9/11, more than people realize. And maybe not more than they were willing to see, but it hasn't been an informed choice on their part. When they think I'm willing to give up a little democracy here to have more security, they don't know how much they're giving up, and they don't know how little more security they're getting. So I think we need whistleblowers just to inform us that we have to resist this government effort to cut off unauthorized contacts between journalists and potential whistleblowers, and that's what Obama has been trying to do.
I'm speaking with Dan Ellsberg, who is at the National Press Club right now in Washington, D.C. You're listening to the broadcast. Dan, in just the couple of minutes we have here left, how do you think your case would have moved forward differently had it happened today? Do you think you would be facing what Chelsea Manning is now facing?
That's a good question. I'm surprised they don't get asked that more often. I can give you a quick answer.
Yeah.
I have no doubt at all that if I had put out thousands of pages of top secret documents revealing lies by our government, breaking of treaties, total deception of the country, getting us into an unnecessary and wrongful and hopeless war, as in the case of Vietnam, but is equally true of Iraq in our recent past and of some wars we are sliding into right now. If I had put that out now, I have no doubt at all that Holder, the Attorney General, and that President Obama would have confronted me with as many charges as I faced, 12 felony counts, a possible 115 years. And now I would have to say, under this mood, move the precedents here and the 9/11 precedent that has understandably frightened everyone so much, I would almost surely be convicted. And I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be in prison.
Dan, you've long called for whistleblowers to step forward. Now it seems like we're in an era where more have done so. But the punishments keep getting harsher, and the result of those leaks sometimes seem to be more minimal. Almost no action is sometimes taken, you know, in the light of Edward Snowden leaks and so forth. So is it still worth it, as you see it, Dan, for national security whistleblowers to come forward? Or is the penalties, you know, 30 years for Chelsea Manning, 2 years for John Curacao and so forth, for helping to expose illegal U.S. torture programs in his case, is the penalty now no longer worth the price of stepping forward unless you're David Petraeus?
Yes, it can be worth stepping forward even if it costs your life, either physically or life in prison, because the stakes can be so high that it doesn't take much probability greater than zero in order to have a chance of changing it. The truth is, telling the truth in a country, big country like ours, an imperial country, basically, about what we're doing abroad that's been lied about, never has much chance of changing things. All one can say is the chance is not zero, and that the stakes are extremely high, and it's worth your life to try to avert these terrible wars, these useless wars, or violations of the Constitution that diminish our democracy, like the mass surveillance, warrantless surveillance, in which case the government has not been able to come up with a single terrorist attack that was prevented by that or any use that was done at all, despite their claiming how necessary it is. The Director of National Intelligence said 58 terrorist attacks were prevented by the mass warrantless surveillance that Edward Snowden revealed. And when Senator Wyden pressed him on the Intelligence Committee, well, let's have the specifics of some of them. What exactly, what can you tell us? Well, it's all very secret. We can't tell you. No, just tell us one or two, three, four. They came up with one case, not 58, which consisted of an $8,000 donation by a taxi driver somewhere in the Midwest to a group in the Mideast that might be associated with terrorism. That was it, not a terrorist attack.
Yep.
That was found by mass warrantless surveillance. That's it.
Yep.
And for that, we're giving the government blackmail capability against every person in the country who may have communicated something on their credit cards, their chat mail, their chat log, their email, their pay, their faxes, whatever. Mm-hmm. All of which the NSA has, something that person doesn't want revealed, whether it's criminal or not, and that's a capability for blackmail that the East Germans secret police, the Stasi, could only dream of having. It simply didn't exist before. I don't want us to be a democratic country like the German Democratic Republic, the East German Republic. And our NSA now has a capability for a police state that has not yet been put into practice in terms of putting people into camps and blackmailing, detaining them, assassinating them, the way it was done in East Germany. But that could happen from one day to the next.
It could happen.
They have the data. They have the data, and they could turn us into a police state fast.
Yep.
That's a terrible situation, and one that Ed Snowden wanted to change. And in my eyes, he's a hero for taking the risks that he did to do that.
The fact that so many Democrats are out there now feeling like, well, at least it's a Democrat in the White House. He'll be OK. We can trust him with all of this material. Newsflash for Democrats. There will not be a Democrat in the White House forever. Now is the time to do something about it. Dan Ellsberg, you say Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning are heroes. I say you're a hero. And I want to thank you for your years of unapologetic, unceasing service to this country, going all the way back to the Pentagon Papers, which is now 45 years ago, if my math is correct. You have been unflinching in your support of whistleblowers throughout all of those years. So I want to thank you for doing what you see as the right thing for this country and for those whistleblowers who have stepped out, following, frankly, in your footprints, Dan.
Thank you.
Thanks for that.
Thank you very much, Brad, for that. I have to tell you that in those 44 years or so, not too many people on the media have taken the opportunity to ally themselves with me, in effect, on this. So I appreciate it. And let me return the compliment in one way. I've been talking about the erosion and the dangers to our democracy. You, Brad, for years now, I've been following you and the work you've done on the effect of election rigging, the election machine question, and the question of defrauding, really, us on the whole election process. That's another threat to our democracy. And by the way, we could use a lot of whistleblowing on that, not only within the government, but from places like these election machine corporations that do it. I would like to hear some people telling the truth from in there and confirming that what Brad Friedman has been saying about the dangers to our process are absolutely right. So thank you for doing what you've been doing.
Bless you, Dan. And yeah, we're working on it. Dan Ellsberg, follow him at Daniel Ellsberg on Twitter and, of course, at Ellsberg.net. Thank you, my friend, for those kind words and for taking more time with us today, Dan.
Same here. Bye, Brad.
Okay, Dan Ellsberg, gotta love him. Gonna take a quick break here and come back with more Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Welcome back. It's your Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, finishing up the first day of our daily Bradcast. It may not be the daily show, but it is a daily show. So there's that. We got just a few minutes left here. We're running late with the Dan Ellsberg interview. If you missed any portion of today's program, by the way, you'll be able to get it later on tonight at bradblog.com, at Stitcher, at TuneIn, at iTunes, where we hope you'll give us a good review over there so it helps other people find the Bradcast as well. Very quickly, Loretta Lynch was finally sworn in today as the new U.S. Attorney General. She replaces Eric Holder, becomes the first African-American woman to become U.S. Attorney General. For some bizarre reason, Republicans held her off for about 170 days, and for some bizarre reason, they hated Eric Holder. Or at least they pretended to. Why would they hate him? I can't tell you. He let all of their bankers pretty much off the hook entirely. He even let them get away with all sorts of voter suppression, frankly, not bothering to actually enforce the Voting Rights Act provisions until after the Supreme Court killed the most important part of that Voting Rights Act in the summer of 2013. So you'd think they would like him. I think they do. I think they were just kind of pretending when they acted like they didn't like him. Also, George W. Bush, according to Bloomberg's Josh Rogan, this is amazing, attacked President Obama in a closed-door meeting with a Republican Jewish organization run by Sheldon Adelson in Las Vegas over the weekend. Did you hear about this story, Des? Called Obama naive. Calls Obama, this is George W. Bush calling Obama naive in his dealings with Iran and in his war against ISIS.
He's criticizing Obama's foreign policy.
That's right.
The mind reels.
Yes, he says the Iran deal he describes as short-sighted, says the guy who during his own administration saw Iran's nuclear capabilities And the number of centrifuges go from something like 600 up to like 19,000 while he was in office. And Bush warned against chaos, in the Middle East.
He would know.
Thanks to Obama's policies. Really, that's what happened. one more point I wanted to get. Des, last week on the show, we talked about this crazy right-wing group, the Heartland Institute. It was on Earth Day, and the statements that they put out about Earth Day. Now, Heartland Institute, it's funded by, I think, the Koch brothers, by the
fossil fuel industry. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. They're huge. They lead the climate change denialist movement in this country. And on Earth Day, when they could have just put out something, you know, oh, we love the Earth. We must take care of it. We must be great stewards. They said that for about 10 seconds, and then they went into, however, environmentalists have completely hijacked the Earth, and all of our problems on the Earth were solved as of 1980, and global warming doesn't exist. In any case, now they're sending out a contingency to a contingent to the Pope to speak to him. Heartland's experts will send this message to Pope Francis, according to a press release Heartland put out. Please do not put the enormous weight of your moral authority behind the discredited and scandal-prone United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Instead, they say, speak out for the poor and disadvantaged of the world who need affordable and reliable energy to escape grinding poverty. Quote, the Holy Father is being misled by experts at the United Nations who have proven unworthy of his trust, said Heartland President Joseph Bast. Humans are not causing a climate crisis on God's green earth, he said. In fact, they are fulfilling their biblical duty to protect and use it for the benefit of humanity.
Wow.
Though Pope Francis's heart is surely in the right place, he would do his flock and the world a disservice by putting his moral authority behind the United Nations' unscientific agenda on the climate. And they go on to say, the science is not settled. Global warming is not a crisis. The world's poor will suffer horribly if reliable energy, the engine of prosperity and a better life, is made more expensive and less reliable by the decree of global planners. Desi, you are my co-host and the managing co-host of the Green News Report and the managing editor thereof. What do you say to the Heartland Institute?
Well, two things. First of all, it's all bunk. But the Heartland Institute, you know, when they talk about this energy poverty, that somehow the poor will be hurt by not being forced to burn fossil fuels for energy, 7 million people die every year from just air pollution alone, not including all the other pollution and destruction that happens when fossil fuels are used. So that's one. And two, renewable energy is clean, it's affordable, and it's actually going to be the thing that helps the third world, the poorer countries, to bypass the whole pollution phase of development. So obviously Heartland Institute is running scared. They want to prevent the Pope from pushing for climate action, especially because he's coming to the United Nations in September to talk to the United Nations and help complete an international climate treaty. So they're doing everything they can at the Heartland Institute to stop that.
And they're not going to be successful, are they?
Oh, heavens no!
The Pope will be paying no mind to the Heartland Institute.
That's right. He plans a big encyclical. That's, you know, a big papal paper that he puts out where he talks about this is what we're going to do. It has the moral force of the church behind it. It directs the bishops. It directs Catholics on what they should do. And they're going to host a climate summit this week in Rome. And that's why Heartland is going there. They're trying to talk the Pope out of doing what he said he's going to be doing all along. Yeah, that's going to work.
Did you say a big papal paper?
Yeah, I was trying to think. How do you say encyclical?
Okay.
It's a big paper that he puts out.
The big papal paper.
Uh-huh.
All right. Tomorrow, by the way, I think we got the gyrocopter guy, if I'm not mistaken.
Awesome.
I think he'll be joining us, the guy who landed at the Capitol in his gyrocopter to protest the Citizens United decision. Looking forward to speaking to him. My thanks to Desi Doyen, our producer today, to Cynthia Cohn, our booking goddess, to engineering magician Tony Sorrentino, to my friend Gregory Hainer of Scorpio Sound, Cassandra Fairbanks of Sputnik News, and of course, my guest whistleblower and legend, Dan Ellsberg. Okay, is that it? Have we survived the first daily broadcast?
Yes, we have survived it.
All right, excellent. We will be back same Brad time, same Brad channel tomorrow. Hope you will tune in. Until then, you can find me on the Twitters at TheBradBlog and, of course, at BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.